Hi, welcome to the latest installment of the Freshfields Digital Podcast. I'm Mark Austin, a London partner, and I'm here today with Lars Meyer.
Hello.
Fellow partner in Germany. And we're going to talk today about the startup and tech scene in Europe. So kicking off, I mean, I thought what we'd first do is talk about insights on the IPO market, both in the UK and Central Europe. I mean, in Germany, Lars, how are you seeing things at the moment?
Well, I think overall we're seeing that the tech IPO market has definitely matured. We're seeing better access to capital generally and a track record of successful IPOs. But we've had Adyen, a Dutch payment services provider, with a successful IPO. We've seen Avast, a Czech cybersecurity company. And recently in Germany, we've seen IPOs of HelloFresh, Delivery Hero, all of which have been successful in one way or another.
Yes. And then in London, I mean, London obviously is afflicted a little bit by the uncertainty surrounding Brexit. And obviously that continues in a very real sense at the moment. And no one is quite sure how that's going to play out yet. Having said that, London saw the IPO of Funding Circle, which was the first big fintech IPO actually in London, and much anticipated. People have been waiting for that for a long time. And in a sense, I think that in London there will be a sort of a pause in terms of companies coming to market for a little bit while people work out what the impacts of Brexit are and actually what Brexit is going to look like. But there is, if you look further out, there is a fairly long pipeline. And I do think that Funding Circle has put the idea of an IPO into quite a number of other companies' heads, that it is something that's feasible. It's something that you can do now. The sector is sufficiently mature to do it. And although Funding Circle's share price, you know, hasn't shot up since IPO, that is partly because of market factors and some other particularly bespoke points. But actually, the business is performing well. And I think everyone's confident that in the long term, medium and long term, it's going to be a very, very successful business. And so we are seeing a lot of the pipeline is very strong. So I think that we might not see any more deals actually coming to market until March this year. Would you agree with that in Central Europe?
I think it's very much the same impression we have in Germany and in continental Europe. One thing to note, I think, from all of these, many of these IPOs, is that a successful IPO does not necessarily translate into success in the public markets. And so you always have to see how it ultimately plays out long term for these companies. What we're also seeing in Germany and continental Europe, and I'm sure it's similar in the UK, is you don't necessarily need to be a proven winner nowadays with big sales, big profits to do a successful IPO. But you see earlier stage companies after a B or C series financing looking at an IPO as a way to generate funds for growth. And you know, as long as companies have a USP, have a strong team, and have the right equity story, we even see earlier stage IPOs, or at least companies, we're talking to companies considering that.
In fact, we were overseeing a company that's just on a Series C and who is thinking about floating next year. That is, as you say, Lars, relatively unusual, because normally you're up to a Series E or F by the time companies float. But actually, as you say, if you've got the right business and you've got a strong team and the company's ready in terms of its systems and controls and the rigor it applies to its business to go public, there's no reason not to. Maybe it's worth us talking a little bit about systems and controls. I mean, there is obviously a fairly big transition from being a private tech company to being on the public markets. What are some of the points that you see the companies need to start thinking about to prepare for that?
Well, one thing, especially in the German market, that's quite remarkable, I think, is that, you know, obviously companies have to think about converting into the right legal form to do the IPO. And in Germany, it's become almost market standard now among tech companies to convert into a European stock corporation, an SE, prior to doing the IPO. It's a preferred legal form for various reasons, one being that it allows for greater flexibility in some of the governance features that you have in a stock corporation. For example, you can have either the continental European style supervisory board and management board, or you can have a single board, which is more US or UK style, but it allows for that type of flexibility, and it's almost become the standard legal form, the standard vehicle for IPOs in the German market. So that's definitely one thing. And then obviously, you know, I'd be keen to hear from you as well, from the Funding Circle experience, how governance is being structured, how companies cope with reporting obligations and just being a public company and being obviously subjected to more scrutiny from shareholders and other stakeholders.
Sure. Taking your point about the corporate form first, most companies in London, when they list, think very hard about whether or not they should have a UK list co, so whether it should be a UK company that actually is the float company. And most people do tend to do that. I think you probably, if you did an empirical study, you'd find that most people tend to do that. That's partly because it's understandable to investors in London. They know the corporate form, they're familiar with it. But it has the added benefit of meaning that if you go for a premium listing in London, which is the gold-plated form of listing that exists in London over and above the EU standard minimum, then if you're a UK PLC, you automatically get entry into the FTSE 100 indices if you have a 25% free float, which is the minimum free float that you can have, i.e. shares in public hands. So, and generally that's thought to be a positive thing to be in those indices because you get the tracker funds, etc., following you, and therefore it's good for the share price and performance of the business post IPO. That's not to say that there are not companies, and there are quite a lot of them, that don't have a UK topco, who maybe don't care about FTSE indices so much, or actually have a 50% free float, which is what you need if you're not a UK company to get into the FTSE. So really, that decision can be driven by tax planning reasons as to what is the best form or jurisdiction of incorporation of the topco. It's an interesting point you raise about governance and reporting obligations as a public company. As you say, we advised Funding Circle on their IPO, and that was one of the big points because obviously young tech companies, they are fairly dynamic, entrepreneurial by definition organizations, and most founders like information to flow freely within them. It's been an important part of the culture. It also generally means that a lot of the employees own shares, which we can come on to in a minute as well, and the implications of that. But when you're a public company on the public markets, you're obviously subject to the public rules around disclosure, the market abuse regulation that applies on a pan-European basis. And that flow of information very often has to change because you can't just send out, as is the case of many of these companies, a daily update emails on how the business is performing to everyone in the organization, because you're simply making them all insiders, and various regulators, including the FCA, don't look very kindly on that. And there are obviously liability risks associated with it. So with Funding Circle, we had to think very carefully with them and calibrate a structure that allowed them to share the information they wanted to share internally on a continuing basis so that the culture wasn't unduly disturbed, while at the same time complying with those very different and more onerous disclosure obligations.
I think a very important point you brought up as well, Mark, is planning ahead. So not just in terms of finding the right legal form, converting into that legal form, which is something that we've been helping a lot of tech companies with in Germany especially, but also things like planning for a dual track, for example, and how you're going to go about your IPO. Is it your one means of raising capital and of shareholders converting their equity into or exiting? Or is it a way of maybe increasing competitive tension in an auction and in a trade sale exit, for example, to either a strategic acquirer or to a private equity sponsor? That's one that also requires planning ahead and certainly is something that if you run a dual track as a startup or a slightly more mature tech company, it binds a lot of resources, it takes a lot of time, and it's a very complex exercise to do. And another one is certainly planning ahead in terms of the features you've mentioned around governance, around reporting, and just preparing for being out there in the open at some point after the listing, being subject to scrutiny from not just shareholders, but stakeholders in general.
I think whether or not a particular process is run as a dual track depends a little bit on the shareholder register. Because if you've got, say, we've got private equity funds sitting on there, and even VCs, very often they will want the optionality around a dual track. Very often the processes are IPO led, and very often they're informal dual tracks, whereby you are executing an IPO, but obviously as you move through that, and particularly when the process becomes public, it attracts interest from potential buyers, and then you get a bit of tension in the process. And so we see numerous transactions where, just in terms of planning, at the outset, you set up the process so that the materials you're creating on the IPO track can equally be used on any sale track should there be an offer that you can't refuse that hoves over the horizon as a part of the IPO process. So, you know, one of the key things in that, and we would say this, wouldn't we, but is actually picking the right advisor. There are people who have done dual tracks and there are people who have done not so many, but we always say that the art of the good dual track is knowing how to allow the company to do its day job, because it doesn't have to be two transactions. It can be one and a half transactions if you have a good advisor that is segueing the two together in an efficient way for management to allow them to actually keep running the business. And one other thing that sometimes is worth thinking about is whether or not part of an IPO process is worth exploring whether bringing in a cornerstone investor would be a useful anchor to the process. That was something that happened on Funding Circle. So Heartland, who I'm a big Nordic investor, came in and undertook to take 10% of the offer, provided it was in certain price parameters. And it was very, very useful for Funding Circle because it gave some price guidance on the IPO. And it also gave a certain level of certainty that the transaction was going to go ahead, because, you know, although the offer to the general public was then smaller, it did mean that actually there was greater execution certainty because of that. There was a slightly smaller offer. And obviously it was helpful for Funding Circle to know they had a very supportive investor on board at a very good price. So it's a thing worth thinking about. In terms of other planning, one of the things that we found, particularly in the fintech world, is the regulatory side of things. A lot of fintech is still nascent in terms of its regulatory development. The regulators are actually normally, you know, if not level, a bit behind where the actual fintechs are themselves. And when you're going public, you have to describe your compliance with the regulatory world. You have to explain it to investors. And that can be a bit of a challenge because if you're describing, you know, like in America, where largely each of the states has a different, for example, in peer-to-peer lending, has a different regime. So you have to place an early emphasis on making sure that you, one, are compliant in each of those areas, and if it's of a grey area, that you can explain it cogently and in a way that investors can understand without it raising more questions. So I think that's an early area. And also the contractual estate. You often find that companies come to start thinking about an IPO, and they then discover they've got office cabinets anymore, but they've got masses and masses of files full of contracts that they've signed over the previous funding rounds in the last few years, and actually they're not in any feasible order. And you actually need to make sure that at an early stage you go through all of those and get your head around them and what that estate looks like and where the bodies may be buried, if there are any, in those agreements. And obviously you need your lawyers to help you with that.
Yes, and I think that's a very good point also. It's almost stating the obvious when you're thinking about planning ahead, but making sure that as you progress through the various funding rounds, as governance documents get renegotiated, you maintain your proper regime for what can trigger an IPO, what the rights of the various investors are, and how the IPO is implemented. And having a clear path to the IPO without a lot of friction is a very important point. And it's something that when we review shareholder agreements that have gone through various rounds of funding and negotiations, you do see ambiguities and you do see points where you just need to discuss with investors and make sure that you're very clear as to what you're trying to achieve in what time frame.
And you often find that documents that have been drafted on private funding rounds don't always work perfectly on an IPO. So it's an area of focus very early on, very often, and one that you should work through to make sure everyone has a common understanding. Just reminds me, actually, Lars, your point about governance is also one area where we always recommend, don't we, that people plan early is the board. Because in the UK, premium listed companies are subject to the UK Corporate Governance Code and they have to comply with it, or they have to explain their non-compliance with it in the prospectus and also in every annual report once they're listed. So it's not a strict compliance point, but investors won't expect material deviations from it. And obviously a private company board does look very different to a public company board. It may have appointee directors of the shareholders. It may be smaller than a public company board. And actually, focusing on that at an early stage is very important, because it often takes longer than anticipated to find new independent directors to come onto the board. They may not be around. They may have full desks already. You also have to pay attention to diversity, quite rightly, imperatives these days. So that is a process that can take many months and should be started early. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's key. Maybe coming to risk. Obviously, in the prospectus, you'll need to flag key risks affecting the business. but it's equally something, if you're running a dual track, that investors will be focused on in diligence, and especially with tech companies, in terms of risk factors. What we've been seeing is obviously the risks that are very high on the public agenda these days, which is cyber risk, which is the question, everything around data ownership, data privacy, data security, but also from a regulatory perspective, data sharing. To what extent can my subsidiaries ultimately share data with parent companies in other countries, for example? How is GDPR compliance being ensured? And is the company GDPR compliant? Those types of points where regulation, but also cyber risk and potential cyber breaches cross paths, I think very important and very interesting to investors doing diligence or listening to whether this is a sustainable business and what the equity story looks like.
It reminds me as well, another area of risk that we often see is that, and coming back to this point about a lot of employees in young tech companies owning shares, is actually talking early when you're planning around sell down. It can be a very emotive issue because an IPO is very often a fairly meaningful liquidity event, both for management and for employees. And deciding early on how that sell down is going to look, how much your individual is going to be allowed to sell. Are they going to be allowed to sell anything between up to a maximum percentage and anything in between down to naught, or is it set percentages? Are they going to be allowed to do tax planning transfers, for example, ahead of the IPO? There's a fair amount of flexibility that you can build into the process if you want to, but you have to remember that that is all extra execution risk in the context of what is already a complex and time-consuming, costly process.
It plays to a broader point, which we call regulation horizon scanning, as in not just with regard to the listing itself, but also with regard to the business. What regulations are on the horizon, both from an EU perspective, for example, from domestic regulators or legislatures, but also countries and markets that these companies may want to venture into. So, for example, the proposed platform regulation in the EU, which may put quite some constraints on online marketplaces or social networking, is certainly one example where you need to scan that closely in order to be prepared as and when it happens and see what impact it may have on the business and hence on your equity story.
And another example is banking licenses. So fintechs at the moment, you've got Monzo, Starling, N26, Revolut, Tandem. There's a whole host of fintechs doing incredibly well at the moment. And those are not yet at a point where I think they are thinking about IPO, but a lot of them are thinking about banking licenses, expanding their financial services. And I completely agree with you, Lars, that horizon scanning exercise and working out what the requirements are and whether compliance with them is something that can be achieved and in what time frame is very important.
So, Mark, we've talked about preparing for an IPO. We've talked about the risks that you should be mindful of when preparing and when actually doing the listing. Looking further down the road, once the IPO is completed, the company is public, what other unforeseens and other issues do you see or have you seen in the UK market that are worth pointing out?
Sure. One reminds me, I don't think it's a UK market specific point, but one perhaps interesting observation I would make is that I recently was up at the headquarters of a company that had floated, and they obviously are very proud to be listed, quite rightly. The business is performing very well, but they are now subject to the vagaries of a live share price. And obviously, as we all know, share prices can go up and down due to world events, macro political events, and that's obviously the case at the moment, not just due to the performance of the business. It can be a sector-wide thing as well. And it's not uncommon for companies to put up in a fairly public place what their share price is on a live screen, because it binds everyone into it. It's an important part of the culture, new culture of the company. And I think there are examples where companies have thought, well, maybe post IPO, it's sensible on one level, but perhaps on another it's not. Particularly if you're in a market where things are a little tricky, and if the share price is sometimes in the green, but often in the red as well at that particular time, I think people have sometimes thought twice about whether or not it's actually that sensible to have a live share price screen, because it can sometimes impact morale unnecessarily and unfairly, because actually the business is performing very well. It's just that there are larger forces at work in the market at that particular time that mean that the whole stock market is down or the whole sector is down. So that's one interesting point, which I think people have sometimes they think twice about. So what about you, Lars? Any interesting points that you would raise that perhaps sometimes are a bit unforeseen?
Well, the one additional point I would mention is that obviously employee incentivization and incentivization of key management gets revamped post an IPO world. And it also then depends on the stock price and how it develops. And that can also have an impact on how these people are incentivized and how the key team actually feels about the business and about their position in the business. And so this is one where you lose control to a certain extent, given that it depends on the share price. But it's also an opportunity to keep people properly incentivized and have a long-term prospect in the business.
Well, thank you very much, Lars. Great talking with you. And if you're interested in listening to more podcasts from us, do go to www.freshfields.com/digital, where you can see what else we have to offer.